Welcome, everybody. My name is Patty Whipler, and I'm the founder and the program director at Hand in Hand Parenting. And I have with me Lawrence J. Cohen, Larry Cohen, my good friend. And Larry is a practicing therapist in Brookline, Massachusetts. He's a father and a stepfather, and such a good one. And he's the author of Playful Parenting, and he's the co-author of The Art of Roughhousing, a wonderful book, and a book called Best Friends, Worst Enemies, Understanding the Social Lives of Children. And I really think Playful Parenting is a superb book. I cannot recommend his book highly enough to you all who, if you haven't read it, it's really inspiring. The stories that he tells are just, I read those stories and I say, how did he think of that, you know? And the way he explains the inner workings of children's emotions and their behavior is very clear, very easy to understand, very compassionate, and very practical ideas. So, Larry, welcome.
Thanks, Patty.
Yeah. And you can reach Larry at playfulparenting.com. He's got articles. He has an excellent newsletter that he sends out, and he has events that he does around Brookline, Massachusetts, which is near Boston. So you can get a hold of Larry that way, and I'll mention that at the end of the phone call again. So while people are getting here, I'm going to give a little thumbnail sketch of Hand in Hand and of our parenting approach called Parenting by Connection, which is what Larry and I are going to be talking about tonight. And the basics of the approach are that parents are good, that we do the very best we can always, and that children, however squirrely their behavior becomes, however difficult, you know, they, whatever the difficult behaviors that they might be caught in, are also good, and all they really want, and all we really want, I think, at heart, is just to be connected, to be close, and to be connected. And when children can feel connected to us or to the people who are caring for them, they think well. Their mind is in full gear, and they can cooperate, they can play well, they can include others, they can learn, they can ask for what they need, they can really do lots to make their own lives good. You know, they can make the best of difficult situations over and over again, as long as they feel close and connected. And so it's very simple, really. In order for children's minds to work, they need to feel connected. But the fly in the ointment is that children's sense of connection is very fragile. And all it takes is you taking a phone call or you going in to check on their younger sibling. And all of a sudden they can feel disconnected. They can feel like you never do what they want, or you never give them enough of what they need, or suddenly they need all your attention, you know, not these other things that you are doing. And their behavior can go off track in a millisecond. And what's happening there is that hurt feelings have gotten kicked up by some tiny little situation, which ordinarily they would be fine with, but somehow there's enough hurt stored in their emotional memory that there's lots of little tripwires, and somehow you stumbled into a tripwire, and all of a sudden off-track behavior is right there in front of you and difficult to handle. And they don't mean to be difficult, and they don't mean to push your button, but when they can't think, they can't think. And it's their job, really, as we see it, to show us that they're having trouble functioning well. And then it's our job to try to figure out how to connect again so that their mind can be of a whole, and they can feel safe and secure and really have access to their whole learning power and their whole cooperation power that they were, you know, that they came here with, all of this wonderful intelligence. And so Hand in Hand has 6 listening tools, 2 for parents so that we can keep offloading the emotional tension that gets in our way of feeling, you know, warm and generous towards our children, and of thinking well about how to resolve difficulties that pop up in front of us. And 4 listening tools, parent to child, which help parents focus on the ways that children can begin to feel us there, and ways, you know, practices that you can do on a regular basis to help children feel the connection that they need to feel with you in order for their minds to function well. And we'll both be talking about, you know, connection and what, you know, what kinds of fearful things disconnect children and then how to repair that connection. But I think the foundational idea in there about repairing connection is that when children can have a good laugh, can cry hard, or in particular around fear and anxiety, when they can thrash and scream and cry and protest and feel really deeply threatened and sweat and tremble, and have you stay there with them and sort of be their emotional anchor while they feel all the emotions of whatever the deep threat was that instilled that fear inside of them, that they then can move through that fear and not be so scared. And their behavior can change sometimes overnight if you give them a chance to show you how desperate they feel and at the same time be confident that all is actually well. So your attention and your goodwill and your ability to hang with a big emotional episode is very, very healing. It can really relieve your child of lots of difficulties. So children's emotional release is really important to their forward progress, and parents having a chance to talk to each other and release feelings is really important to our forward progress as well. And that's hand in hand, is sort of our mission, is to help you access good support, help you build good support, help you get the tools you need to help your children with all the effectiveness that you desire. So that's hand in hand. We're a nonprofit, and that's all I'm going to say right now. I've asked Larry to sort of start us off with some picture of how children become anxious and how to think about them in the middle of their troubles with anxiety and what we can do. So, Larry, go ahead.
Thanks, Patty. I just want to say first that for those of you who are new to Playful Parenting and me, I just want to say hi. And those of you who came on this call because you know Playful Parenting and you're new to Hand in Hand, you're in for a treat. And it feels like giving back for me to be part of things with Hand in Hand, because I first met Patty when my older daughter was a baby, and we both fell in love with her, and our lives have not been the same. And it was really not just so much that I learned, but the inspiration is really why I started to put parenting at the center of my work, supporting parents at the center of my work with families. So I'm glad to be here. So about anxiety, it's such a broad concept. We use the word to mean so many different things, and I want to kind of give an overview of how I think about anxiety. And that is, we have this I call it the anxiety security system. And we need anxiety. If we didn't have any, we would just walk in front of a bus. We wouldn't think, oh, that bus might kill me, I better not do that. We wouldn't have a conscience. Our conscience keeps us in line by like, oh, I don't know if I should do that. We have that little twinge of anxiety. So it's not a bad thing. The problem is that some people have too much. Some people really struggle with it. And we have this system, and I'll use an example to see all the parts of the system. So if you imagine you're on a hike in the woods and you see a long, skinny object on the path in front of you on your hike, and before you even have a thought, you jump back, and let's say you're with your child, you put your arm protectively around your child and you jump backwards, and then you have the thought, oh no, it's a snake. And these happen, the alert that you're on, it happens before the speed of thought. It's faster than the speed of thought. And the fear, your body is in fear mode. You're ready to run. You're ready to fight. Our bodies they work so fast. Then you have the thought, oh no, it's a snake. Then you have a little bit slower, maybe half a second instead of instant, you have the thought, oh, it's a stick. And then your mind, we have a different part of the brain. It's actually located in a different spot, what I call the all clear signal. The, oh, it's a snake, it's a stick, I can relax. So the alert is one part, and the alarm is the next part, and then the all clear as the last part. And people who have children who struggle with a lot of anxiety, things can go wrong with each one of these parts. They can be on constant alert, so they can never really relax and enjoy life because they're always on the lookout for danger. When they see a stick or a cloud, they can be dramatically alarmed. We're going to get hit by lightning. It's a stick. The response is really big. And they have a weak all-clear signal. So they might not even hear themselves, that part of themselves, saying, it's a stick. Often what happens, if you imagine the child on the hike, they run away, and you're yelling after them, it's a stick, it's a stick, it's okay. They're like, no, 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 and they're running back to the car. And they know, because they avoid, they don't ever get that reality check and that comfort that comes from looking and saying, oh, it's a stick. So avoidance really gets in the way. And avoidance is part of why it gets stuck. So a child gets afraid of something, and they get this stuck spot. And this alert, alarm, all clear, I think helps explain why there's so many different types of anxiety. You can have all the physical signs, trembling and sweating and shaking. You can have worried thoughts, what if, what if, what if. You can have nervous behaviors, fingernail biting, shirt chewing, all these different things. And in order to overcome any kind of fear, we have to face it. We have to get close to it. And this is where parents are so important, because there are two extremes that aren't too helpful. One extreme is, get over it. I don't want to hear about it. Don't be a baby. You know, throw you in the deep end of the pool. And that's one extreme. And the other extreme is, oh, don't worry. Oh, you're scared of the water? You don't have to go in the water. Oh, you're scared of dogs? We'll just stay inside. You're scared of school? We'll just stay home. And this doesn't do our children any favor either. So we have to give them a push, but a very gentle, loving push. And this is where the connection that Patty was saying is at the center. This is where the connection comes in, because for that push to really work, it works best if we have a strong connection with our child. And here's one example. I call it the stop-and-go game. So a child is afraid of dogs, let's say. And so you start in their room and you say, I know you're afraid of dogs, and I'd like to give you a hand with that. Let's play the stop-and-go game. And the stop-and-go game is, we're going to walk outside and go find a dog. But we're going to walk very, very slowly. And every time you say stop, we'll stop. And every time I say stop, we'll stop. And every time somebody says go, we'll go. And so you say, okay, let's go. And your child says, stop! And then you show you're on your child's side by freezing. And you stop. And then you stop for a minute. And then you say, okay, go. And then you take a baby step. You do this very slowly. Now, you might have 1,000 stop and goes. You might not get through it all in an hour. You might not get outside to the dog. You might have to start over again another time. But within a few times, you will get to where you're petting the dog. And along the way, you might have a time where you stop and your child tells you everything they're afraid of about dogs. Or they climb into your arms and cry and cry and cry. Or they shake and shake and shake. And so those feelings come pouring out. And they do it in this context where you're giving them a gentle push, you're not shoving them, but you're not protecting them too much either. Something that, so these are the key issues, I think, this alarm system and all clear system and the edge. There's this edge where you're not avoiding it, but you're not flooded either, and you're just kind of beginning to feel some of those feelings about it. But you can handle those feelings because mom or dad is right here with me. So let's see, what else did I want to say? I want to say that the things that we can do that make the biggest impact that we as parents can do starts with love and affection, lots of play, especially roughhousing play is great for children to build up confidence that helps them with their fears and anxieties. And one of the most important things is to work on our own anxiety. And I'll just tell one story about that. Which is, when Emma was three, my daughter Emma, when she was three, I remember vividly she was climbing on a climbing structure, and I was standing underneath, and I was worried. I am an anxious person, I'll admit. And I was just saying, be careful, be careful, be careful. And somebody came up to me, it was a friend actually, who was there with their kid at the playground and said, you know, Larry, I think that she's going to recover better from a broken arm than from being petrified and timid and scared all her life. Because this person could see that my saying, be careful, be careful, be careful, was bound to create a timid person who was not physically confident. And I tried to think of some good arguments to that, but I just couldn't think of any. I think this person was right. And so I really took that to heart. And I really tried hard to encourage her confidence rather than undermine it with all that, be careful, be careful, be careful. And I'll end with one other story. There was a boy that I was seeing, working with him and his family, and he had a lot of anxieties. And together we came up with this idea that really helped him, and that was to do things that are scary, fun, and safe. And this was a brand new concept for him, because the world was divided into too scary or safe and okay. And he really ran with it. And he came up with a whole list of things that were scary, fun, and safe. And I just contacted his mom recently. It's been a few years because I'm doing some writing now about anxiety. And I asked her how things were going. She said they were great. And she said he still has next to his bed this card that I wrote for him that said, do something scary, fun, and safe. And he has a list underneath it in his handwriting of all the things he's thought of over the years that are scary, fun, and safe. So I'll turn it over to you, Patty, and I'm sure we'll get into a lot of specific things when we get into questions.
Okay. That was beautiful, Larry. Thank you. Thank you very much. So what I want to do is I want to outline three listening tools that I think are helpful for working with a child who is anxious. And but Larry's, you know, advice there, his direction to work on your own anxiety, it's like, I think what we mean by that is find a listener and have that listener, tell that listener all the things that you feel when your child gets anxious, you know, and that can go anywhere from, gosh darn you, why are you such a little wimp, you know, come on, can't we just go to gymnastics? Do we have to go through this every time? Could be that. Or it could be, you know, oh, my poor child, you know, I never felt comfortable in social situations, and now she doesn't either. And oh, my gosh, is she going to have such a shy life and painful life as I have had? And, oh, what have I done? You know, this must be my fault. You know, why haven't I? I mean, it could be anything or everything, but that doesn't really matter what your feelings are. But in general, when our children are scared, it's hard on us, and you take those feelings to a listener, and you look around, and you just see, like, you know, where, you know, you tell them everything, even the stuff that, you know, is embarrassing to tell as a parent. Mm-hmm. And sooner or later, if someone listens long enough, you know, you can get to some laughter yourself, or you can find where the tears are about how much you want for your child and how worried you are about them. And I don't know what the magic is around laughter and tears, but there is something very, very powerful there that, you know, our society is dead set against. It's like, you know, everybody wants us to grow up and button up and, you know, get, you know, put your head on straight and march forward. But when you stop marching forward and just stop and just notice how you feel and show somebody how you feel, it really clears your mind, and it makes all subsequent things easier. So your child will actually know when you've worked on your anxieties. They will, you know, they will, it'll be easier for them to, be easier for you to be effective with them. But here are the listening tools that you would use parent to child. And what I'm going to do is describe these briefly. There are much, you know, there are nice, rich descriptions with more anecdotes in our Listening to Children booklets and lots of articles on our website, so you can get. I'm not going to sort of outline all the ways that you use each tool, but I'm going to put a nod in that direction, kind of indicate how well they can work, and then we'll answer some questions. So the first one, and this is a foundational tool, it's like I think if you're going to use any listening tool, you always want to lead with this one because it helps the child feel safer, and we call it special time. And that is you tell your child, I have 15 minutes, and I want to do whatever you want to do. What do you want to do? And you have to say that it's a time, because otherwise you're just kind of sliding in and sliding back out, and they don't know you gave them special time. They need to know that you're going to give them 100% attention for X amount of time. And you just set your timer so it has a beginning and an end. This, for some reason, has a very powerful effect on their ability to know that they've had your attention. It just points to your attention, your attention, your attention. So that's good. And so with a child who's got anxiety, that's really what you want to do for a start. So we have one of the moms in our instructor training program whose little boy was really quite sick from the time he was born. And he just had a very difficult time physically. By the time he was 2.5, he hated going to the doctors. And then he needed to go to the doctor often. They were still trying to resolve persistent difficulty. So every time he went, he was wiggly, he was whiny, he was like, you know, just kind of hanging on his mom for attention, and she couldn't really pay attention to what the doctor was saying, or really her attention was always divided. So she thought, okay, we have to go back to the doctor. What am I going to do? I'm going to give him special time, and I'm going to start about an hour before we have to go so that, you know, if there's crying after special time, I can handle it, but I'm going to do 30 minutes. So she gave her little boy 30 minutes of special time, and he really dislikes the doctor. So I think the first thing he did was just kind of, you know, bring his little stuffed animals together, and he was having them talk to each other, and then his mom said, I'm going to examine this animal. And so he did little physical examinations on his stuffed animals for about 10 minutes. And then all of a sudden he looks at his mom and he says, Mommy, I want to kill Dr. Jane. And his mom, you know, is trying to, like, go along with this. So she goes, oh, you want to kill Dr. Jane? That sounds like a great idea. And so she brought some enthusiasm in there. And he takes his kangaroo animal and he says, I'm going to smash Dr. Jane. I'm going to kill Dr. Jane with the potato masher. And he runs into the kitchen, gets the potato masher, comes back out, and whacks that kangaroo, you know. And Dr. Jane, you're dead now. And then he laughed and laughed and laughed. And then he's going, Mommy, I want to cook Dr. Jane. Let's cook her. So he goes and he gets a pan from the kitchen and puts the animal in there, and he chops the animal up to little pieces, pretend chopping, and then pretends to cook the animal, and then, Mom, help me eat Dr. Jane. So then his mom kind of still took bites of Dr. Jane, and then the animal was revived again. And he said, Mommy, let's do it again. Now, so he smashes Dr. Jane with a potato masher, and she said they went through this like 5 or 6 times. And the father kind of wandered in and went, kind of raised his eyebrows going, oh, my God, we're killing Dr. Jane in the kitchen here. But she kind of winked at him and said, you know, I think it's okay. So they did lots of killing and eating Dr. Jane for about 20 minutes. And then she said, okay, you know, special time is over. It's time to go see Dr. Jane now. And he goes, okay, Mommy, but I want to bring Dr. Jane. So he picks up his kangaroo animal and sitting in the back seat in the car, and they're driving there, and all of a sudden he says, Mommy, I know this isn't Dr. Jane. I know this is my kangaroo, you know. She goes, oh, yep, you're right. It's not Dr. Jane. And then he goes in, and she spent a whole hour talking peacefully with Dr. Jane. He sat on her lap. He cooperated with the exam. You know, he was interested in the instruments. She asked him questions. He answered. It was like a night and day difference. So just that little special time and that chance to kill Dr. Jane and laugh and laugh and laugh and have his mom be totally enthusiastic and totally behind him really lifted that anxiety. So, and I'm not saying that you're going to have that kind of an amazing special time every time you do it, but it will increase your child's sense of safety, and it will make new things possible. That much I do know. Exactly what, who knows. But so the second listening tool that I want to talk about is play listening, and this is what Larry's book is all about. And boy, if you want to, you know, if you want to have a good read, try his book on play listening. But I'm going to tell you about a mom whose 3-year-old boy got stung by 7 bees or 8 bees. I don't know. He just, the little swarm, he bumped into a yellow jacket's nest and they all stung him. And he's just a little guy and he was just in terrible pain and fright. And he screamed and screamed and screamed all the way home from the park where they were and just kept on screaming. She really listened to him a long time. But after that, he was absolutely terrified of going outside, and he was terrified of any flying insects. So any fly in the house would just send him into terrible anxiety, and he absolutely refused to go outside, and they kind of waited to see if, you know, that he would get over this. And after about 10 days, he was still terrified to go outside, and it's summertime, and it's nice weather, and the mom started thinking, well, we have to figure out how to get some laughter going around this, because that will... That might help. And so when she was playing with him, she decided to be a bee. And so she was a bee and she flew around with her little wings and came close to him. And I don't know, she just was a very benign little bee buzzing around to see what he would do with it. And I don't know, after 5 or 10 minutes, all of a sudden he looked at the bee and he said, "Bah!" You know, and she went, "Ah, help, help!" You know, and she collapsed to the ground. And he laughed and laughed and laughed. And then she got up again and started, you know, buzzing towards him again. And he went, "Bah!" again. And she collapsed again, and he laughed and laughed and laughed. And there was just this tremendous force behind this huge laughter. And you could just see the emotional charge there that's finally getting released, because he's in the powerful role and she was in the scared bee role, scared flying insect role, over and again. Pretty soon the grandpa was playing it and his daddy was playing it, and he loved this game. It just was very attractive. And so for many days they played the bee game, but he still wouldn't go outside. All this laughter and no movement on going outside. So finally she decided to use a third listening tool, which is exactly what Larry was talking about, sort of bringing the child to the edge very carefully and gently with lots of support, and hoping that they can get in and work on the deeper layer of feelings. And so she did stay listening. She just said, "You know, son, we are going to go outside. I'm going to hold you in my arms. I'm going to keep you safe. And when you tell me you want to go back in, we will go back in." And she just held him very close and took him very gently out into the backyard. And he cried and cried really hard for about 2 minutes. And he said, "I want to go back in." And she took him back in and told him what a brave boy he was. And then the next day she said, "Sweetie, we're going to go outside again. And you tell me when you're ready to come back in." And they went outside and he cried again very hard, lots of big crying. And he stayed outside about 4 minutes and then asked to go back in. And they did this for several days in a row, you know, just taking him into the challenge, she would just keep saying, I've got you right here. I'm not going to let anything bad happen to you. I'm protecting you. I'm right with you. You know, you're not alone. It's over. The bee stings are over." So that kind of talk. And he cried every single time for, I think, 6 or 7 times. But it got longer and longer and longer that he could stay outside. And then finally he could go outside on his own. He was really pleased again to be outside, and a flying insect came up to him the first afternoon he was out there, and he looked at it and he went, "Bah!" And the insect, of course, flew away, you know, because insects fly around randomly. And then he went, "Mommy, I made it go away." And he was so pleased with himself. And she knew that the whole thing was over. All of the pain and the hurt that he'd been storing was out of there. When I think the next week a bee landed on his sandal, he had an open sandal, and he looked down and he said, "Mommy, I've got a bee on my sandal. I'm going to walk gently to you, see if it stays." And he just gently walked with the bee on his sandal over to her to show her, you know, that it was there and that it was his friend, and just a remarkable recovery. So I think the last thing that I'll say is that it's what we encourage parents to do is very much what Larry does, which is to propose going toward the scary thing, But if your child can burst into tears just at the idea of the scary thing, then you don't go towards the scary thing. You stay right there where the tears are, and you assist them right where they burst into tears. So however close or far away it is, you know, sweetie, we are going to go into this dark room. And if you're downstairs in the middle of a well-lit kitchen and you say, we're going to go into this dark room, you know, because that's where your bed is, and I'm not going to turn the light on. I want you to get used to it being dark. And your child bursts into tears at the very proposal, then you just stay there, and you listen, and you allow them to release those feelings. It's like that's a safe situation. The idea of the fear is all that it takes for them to release the feelings, and you've got the healing process going. And when they slow down and they're not crying so much, you say, are you ready to go into your dark room now? And if they burst into tears again, you don't make one move towards the dark room. Like, you don't want to overwhelm the child with too much activity while they're working on these deep feelings. You want to keep things safe. You want to keep them, aware of the safety that you offer and aware of your presence. And you might spend 3 nights down there in your kitchen saying, you know, I'm going to help you go into your dark room. And your child might cry for a whole hour. And at that point, you just say, sweetie, you did a really good job on thinking about your dark room. You know, I think that's all we can do for tonight. Why don't you hop into my arms, and we'll go upstairs, and I'll turn the light on in your room, and you can sleep with the light on again tonight. And you just let it be. It's like they did their work. That's all the listening you want to do right now. Right now, you can have it the way that you need it because you have these fears. And tomorrow night, I'll help you think about your dark room again. And then the next night you just go back, and if they still can't get anywhere near their dark room, you listen until they can say, okay, Mommy, I want to go upstairs, but I don't want to go in yet. And then you go upstairs and you say, okay, are you ready to take one step towards it? And then, you know, the tears burst in again. So you propose and you listen. You propose and you listen. You propose and you listen. And you help the child take these little baby steps towards the thing they're really scared of. Meanwhile, they are really healing from the grip of that fear on their ability to be confident and their ability to, you know, feel safe in their world. So that's all.
Can you say, Patty, talk about how it can feel like you're torturing your child when you do that and what to do about that feeling?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So this is hard. This is very hard. But we shouldn't really minimize that. It's like in our lives we have been distracted away, bribed away, shamed away from full entry into the deep feelings that we have. So we have so seldom seen anybody just let their feelings go, you know, just dive into deep feelings. And every time we saw it, it was probably our parents diving into deep anger or deep something that was kind of out of control, where, you know, nobody was helping them, nobody was keeping them safe. So the times we've seen big feelings like this have not been happy, safe, you know, protected times. And so when our children go into really deep feelings, we get what we call re-stimulated. It's like big feelings come up for us. We've got a bundle of them that we never got to shed, and anytime somebody's shedding feelings, everybody else reverberates with all of their unshed feelings. So it can feel pretty scary to do this, and I think Larry's idea of just, you know, going to the edge and then letting the child tell you when they're ready to get back, you know, to move back away from the edge is one way to do it, you know, little chunk by little chunk, so that both you and your child are getting the hang of going towards these big feelings rather than dancing around them all the time. And your listening partnership, it's like having an adult. Well, I think maybe the way to do this is to kind of try to anticipate that after listening to your child cry long and hard, you're going to feel all kinds of ways. And so you want to set up some listening time for yourself for the next day or for that evening. Or, you know, if you don't have a listening partner, you just want to put on music that lets you cry and just have yourself a good cry, you know, in your own company the very best way that you can. Or a good laugh. It's like it doesn't really matter how the emotional tension rolls off, but we need to keep up with our children's healing by, you know, kind of letting some pressure behind the dam go, you know, the dam of stored feelings that we carry, letting some of our own feelings go, and having a good listener, someone who cares about us and who won't get worried about us, is a really good way to do that. So, did you want to say more about that?
Yeah, I think that's just what I wanted to add to that, and I wanted to add to your stories, which I loved, the that we don't always know what triggers the fear, you know. So the second mom understood that the reason the child was scared of a housefly was because of being stung by bees, and that makes a lot of sense. But often our children's fears just don't make any sense to us. And it's very important to still be empathic, even though it doesn't make sense to us. And I think that I call it the package deal. We have this idea like one package is, oh, yeah, that's so scary, that's terrible, you really should be scared of that. And the other package is, what are you scared of that for? And I think we have to unpackage that package deal so that we can say, oh, you're really scared of the toilet flushing. Boy, I can really see you're scared of that. That must be so scary. And boy, if I thought the toilet flushing was going to take me down with it and was something bad would happen, I would be scared too. And that doesn't mean that we're saying you're right to be scared of the toilet flushing. It's dangerous. We can be empathic without agreeing that it's dangerous. And it's a little complicated to convey that I have empathy with your feelings, but I also believe the world is safe.
Yeah. You think we're ready to have some questions?
Yep.
Hi. Thank you so much. This is a great call. I've got a little guy who's 7 who learned from a babysitter to be scared of thunderstorms. And he's terrified of them, but only at night. And so when I'm listening to your examples and like the bee story of, you know, and if there's thunderstorms during the day or talking about them during the day, it's no biggie. It's in the middle of the night, and he shares a room with my daughter who's now becoming scared. So this learning fear is having a trickle down. I'm just wondering in terms of helping support him, obviously when it's happening, but when you're talking, the great examples that you've given, I'm just trying to think of how to do that in the daytime. He's not scared in the day. He can talk about it during the day. If there's a thunderstorm during the day, no big deal. But if there's lightning and thunder and he's in bed, he is hysterical, which is fine. But it's how do I help him work it out? Do you know what I mean?
There's a phrase that I love, which is to say to children when you're having a problem, say, hey, I've noticed that you're having trouble with this. I'd love to help you with it, give you a hand. Let's make a game about it. And so, like, hey, I've noticed that you have you're scared of thunderstorms, but only at night. And have you noticed that? And I'd like to give you a hand with that. Let's play a game about that. Do you have any ideas? So it's always great to get the child's ideas first because they might have great ones you would never think of.
Right.
And then if he doesn't have any ideas, he could say, well, we could pretend it's night, so you could make a little blanket fort.
Okay.
And get inside of it, and it's like, okay, we could pretend it's night, and we can get a flashlight, and it's like, well, let's see, what else should we, what can we use to have be pretend thunder? And you could have something that makes noise to be pretend thunder, and something that is pretend lightning, and you throw out ideas, but mostly you're kind of giving him space to come up with his own game ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that his mind will take him to where he's at that edge, and you know where Patty was saying, you know, that where it's safe to work on the feelings.
Okay.
Because what he's doing is in the daytime, it's all safe. He's in avoidance mode. No problem.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to think about this. I don't have to work on this. Everything's fine. And then a thunderstorm happens at night, and he's flooded. So he needs to find that middle ground where it's safe enough to work on it, and he knows you're there helping him work on it.
And I would say that to sort of couple that approach, I think that's really an important approach, and that might be the first thing the very first thing to do. But the stay with me part is also really important. So in the middle of a thunderstorm, in the middle of the night, mm-hmm. and he's like really, really scared, you want to go in, you want to turn on the light so he can see you, or at least a little light. You want to get close, but not too close. When children are really scared, they want to bury themselves in you, and they don't want
right.
to, they can't hold eye contact. And you need to hold him far enough away from you that you and he can have eye contact. And that might just be like 2 inches. But it's a very important 2 inches, because if he can get in where he can, you know, blank out the eye contact, then he can avoid feeling he can avoid the healing process. And the healing process is screaming, thrashing, crying, clawing, trembling, sweating. And so you need to be close enough so that your presence reassures him, but not so close that he can, that he just is suffering through the fear but not healing it. So you might sit on his bed and hold his hands that say, no, I'm not going to let you into my arms. I'm right here. I'm right with you. And what you do is you just keep up a very steady, a steady stream of, I'm here, nothing bad's going to happen. It's sound that we are not in danger. I've got you right here. I'm not going to leave. I'm not going to go away. You know, we can do this. We can do this. We are safe. You can be here with me, and you can get through this. You made it already. You already made it. With the idea that whatever frightened him happened long ago, and he's still got the fear, but it's, you know, there's nothing more to be frightened of. And so if he can sweat and he can really try hard, fight really hard to be getting into your arms, and you can say, sweetie, I'm gonna hold you, but I'm not gonna hold you quite yet, because we need to be looking at each other. You need to see that I'm not scared, and I need to see how scared you are. I'm right here. I'm not going to go away. So you're keeping enough of it, you know, you're helping him see you, you're helping him feel your presence, but you're not helping him blot the feelings out. You're not helping him go catatonic in his fear. And that can really, until the storm has passed, and beyond that, it's like if he can grab a hold of whatever that deep fear is, he might cry for another hour after there's no more thunder and lightning, and it'll all be on just whatever this deep fear is that, you know, that gets kicked up. So I think both approaches are helpful, and one without the other is nowhere near as effective as both. Does that make sense?
I agree.
So that you can play about it, but you also open up room for him to work very deeply on these fears when the situation is, you know, as scary as it gets for him.
Okay. And would you do it just when it's one-on-one versus other children?
Well, it's helpful for each child to have someone anchoring them. It's harder to anchor two people at the same time if they're experiencing extreme emotions. So if you've got, you know, any help around, I would enlist it.
Okay.
If you don't have help around, then, you know, you do the best you can with two children. Maybe you let one, you know, come close to you and bury themselves in you while you hold the other one out there on the edge where they're feeling the fear for 10 minutes. And then you say, okay, come on in close, you know, I'll hold you. And then you go back and then you go to your other child and you pull her out so that she can see your eyes. And then she, you know, gets to work on the terror for 10 minutes. And then you say, okay, sweetie, take a break. I'm going to listen to your brother now. This is not an easy job, but that can be done.
Thank you.
Yes, you're very welcome, Amy. I'm going to move on here.
Hello. Hi. Yes, my name is Niala. I'm calling in from Kenya.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I've very much been enjoying the call. I was just wondering if you wouldn't mind reviewing. You'd mentioned that there were 3 listening tools for working with an anxious child, and you talked about special time. If you could just recap on the 3 tools for me again, please.
Sure. It's special time, which establishes and plumps up the emotional safety that your child feels with you. And play listening, which is a way of playing with the child so that laughter occurs, and in general, you're playing the less powerful role, and they're being the brave and the bold and the one who's in the know and the smart, and you're being, you know, you just can't figure anything out, and that usually lets children laugh quite a bit. And it's the laughter part that's really healing. And the third one is what we call stay listening, which is what I was just describing for a child terrified in the night. You stay there and you let them see you and you make eye contact, and all kinds of feelings pour out, including very deep desperation and feeling like, oh my God, I'm going to die. And you anchor the child through all of that by letting them see and feel that you are protecting them and that you're there and that you think they're going to turn out okay.
I just add on play listening that, yeah, the play listening that a lot of anxious children try really hard to be tough and to be brave. And boys get a special dose of this, that they're supposed to be tough and they're supposed to be brave. And I find that as a man doing a lot of fake crying during play listening, fake, oh, I can't believe you said that, or, oh, no, it's a pencil, I'm scared of pencils, ah, wah, that children laugh and laugh and laugh and laugh, especially boys, and then they tease me, I can't believe you're scared of pencils. And it just shows, this is coming out of them, and it just shows how humiliated they feel to have this fear, to be scared of whatever they're scared of. And it really helps them to work through it, to ham it up like that.
Thank you for recapping that. Can I just pick up on what you were saying about sharing your fears? Because for the first time, I've started sharing my fears with my daughter, and I was wondering if you had any tips about a helpful way to do that, because previously I wouldn't ever say something scared me, and it was, you know, it's been useful. I've gotten over some of my fears because I've had to be bravely taking a spider out of the house, like I'm not scared. But I would like to be able to be honest with her about, you know, I find this scary too. So do you have any tips about, you know, productive ways to do that?
Yeah, sure. Children know when we're being emotionally dishonest. They read it. They might not read exactly what's going on, but it bothers them. They get it. So it helps to be honest, but it also helps to not have them see the full extent. We don't want to terrify them by falling apart. And so being able to just honestly, matter-of-factly say, ooh, I'm scared of spiders, but somebody's got to get the spider out of the house, so I'm going to do it. And ooh, and I think that modeling, you know, Patty was saying there's this huge wave in our society against showing emotion. And so to just openly say, whoa, whoa, and you're shaking, and you're like, oh, I can't believe I have to hold a spider, wah. And it really lightens it up, and it just models that it's not a big deal to be scared, and when you're scared, you just feel scared, and then you do what you want to do anyway.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. That's incredibly helpful.
Sure. Very glad to
have you.
Thank you.
Hi. Yeah, I'd like to talk about fear of deep water.
Mm-hmm.
My son is 9, and just recently figured out why he's been uncomfortable in water. I mean, now we've gotten to the point where he plays in water and he does swim lessons, and it's just the point where he doesn't want to go in the deep end, where he can't touch. And when he was about 2, when he was out with some other people, he was dropped in the water and swallowed some water and then had croup for days afterwards. And so I've finally figured out, I think, that that's the connection, because it never made sense. Sort of like you were saying before, you know, he was afraid of going in the water, really uncomfortable, and it finally makes sense.
You weren't sure when, yeah. Yeah,
because I wasn't actually there for that, and something triggered that. But the memory of that. So I think that's where it comes from. And so now, just at the point of wondering what to do about it, and I liked all of the suggestions that you mentioned, but two things came up in terms of giving him that gentle push was that, you know, we'd be in a public place,
mm-hmm.
the pool. And then also I just wonder, too, if he might just, you know, really resist the idea altogether and fight against it instead of, you know, sort of bursting into tears. And so I'm wondering how to manage that reaction.
Yes, it certainly isn't always tears. Sometimes it's, I don't like swimming anyway. I don't want to. I don't care. It's not that I'm scared. And it's the same. The approach is the same. I hear you. We're just going to stay right here. And this is important. And the public place is a tricky one, and I think that has a lot to do with the motivation. You know, is the motivation strong enough to work it through? Or can you try doing it symbolically in the bathtub, or, you know, where you pretend, you know, let's pretend. A lot of children who have anxiety have very vivid imaginations, and so they're able to imagine it and pretend.
I can actually think of a game that you could do around that I've done with children sometimes, where if he's splashing around in the, you know, in the shallow end, and this is a game you could do, I think you could probably do it in public, and, you know, and all of a sudden you go, oh my gosh, you're getting in too deep, I'll rescue you, I'll come, I'll
yeah.
rescue you, and then you grab, you know, you grab him around and you drag him back to the shallowest part of the shallow end. Now, oh, phew, you know, and you're sort of playing a role, but you're inviting him to play along. It's like, no, please don't go out that deep again, you know, mm-hmm. and, but it's wink, wink, and,
yeah,
and
oh, no, I can't watch, I can't watch.
Yeah, yeah, and so what you're doing is you're sort of daring him to go out to the edge. He goes, please don't go out that far, you know. I have to come rescue you the minute I see you that deep, you know. And then if he can take the bait, you know, to make you scared and to make you panicked, then he can trace out little by little, oh, please don't go out that far. Wait a minute, I'll get you. And so you play the rescuer, which is what he didn't have then. You know, he didn't have a rescuer, so... But you're also kind of the, you know, the scared, skittish person. And in general, when children are scared, if you play scareder, it's very funny to them. Very funny. So,
mm-hmm.
I don't know, I would try something along those lines of, well, I'll throw you a tube, you know, here's your tube, you know, come on, float back in. Don't go the other way, float, come back into me. And I don't know, just all kinds of little rescue scenarios. And I don't know, you know, The thing that will make it more likely that it could work is you working on the incident. I mean, it's so amazing, actually, how this works. If you work on the fact that you weren't there, you know, what you imagine that was like for him, however you feel badly about it, however frustrated you are that he has this fear and you haven't been able to help, if you get some listening time on this, it makes it much more likely that even if my idea of what might work doesn't work, that you and he together will come up with some way to play with his fear of the deep end, some way for him to be the brave one and you to be the scared one. It's like this particular game might not work, but what makes it likely that you can figure it out is you working on your feelings about this whole ball of wax. I don't know how it works, but it's very, very dependable that if the parent works on the thing that's hard on their child and also hard on them, that then solutions begin to appear from where, I don't know, but the limbic system, the children's limbic system, their social emotional center knows when you freed up some of your worries. They know it and they can make use of that almost immediately. So.
Yeah, the metaphor that I use for that concept, I never thought of it that way, Patty, but I call it the knot of tension, and that certain things develop a knot, and then the knot gets tighter and tighter and tighter. So every time you're trying to get him to go in the deep end and you're frustrated, it gets tighter, and every time he feels bad because his friends are in the deep end and he can't go in, it gets tighter. And all these kinds of games and the play and the lightening it up and the playing you, you're scarier than him, that loosens the knot, and the big cry loosens the knot. And I think that once the knot gets a little looser by you having that listening time or by playing a game together that gets you both laughing about it, then you just suddenly get smarter. I think that as soon as the knot gets looser, then parents get smarter. And you just think of creative things that we can't think of out here in the abstract, and you might not be able to think of when you're really frustrated by it. But
that knot of tension that children have, you are always involved in that knot. It's like it's not just their knot of tension. You are always, always, always involved in that knot. And if you can undo, you know, the part that's yours, they begin to wiggle free too. It's very interesting how tied in with each other we are. So that's a great question.
I just wanted to just clarify one thing, so that if someone laughs enough, is that in terms of laughter is as much of a release as tears?
Absolutely. It might not be enough, so you know, it's always, you know, it's so much nicer to do the laughing, and so I like to start with that, and then if you're still stuck, you might need a big cry. Or your child will let you know. It's like they'll laugh and laugh, and then suddenly they'll have the big cry. And he might, you know, he might have the big cry in public, and it'll be okay.
Right.
Or sometimes what happens is you get the laughter going, and it's really good and rich. And then, you know, you ask him to, like, pick up his shoes. And all of a sudden it's like, you know, I hate you. You're always telling me what to do. I don't want to live in this house anymore. And all of a sudden there's this huge cry over something absolutely and totally unrelated to the fears you've been trying to help him with. And it's all about the shoes. And he has a big cry about, you know, you and the shoes and Kevin knows what. And, you know, when that cry is over, you go back to the pool the next week, and, my gosh, he's floating around in the deep end. It's like you don't, you know, it doesn't always come out looking like it's a cry about the thing you hope that they'll get over. Sometimes it's something, it's the way you cut their toast, for heaven's sakes. Okay. Well, I think we have to end our teleseminar. I hope that this has been helpful. So Larry, again, is at playfulparenting.com with really good resources for parents, and definitely get his book, Playful Parenting.
I just wanted to say that I'm writing a new book about this very topic, helping children with anxiety, and I would love to hear your stories. So and you can get my contact information on playfulparenting.com, but I would love to hear the stories, both what you figured out and what you're still struggling to figure out.
And for hand-in-hand resources that you can turn to, we've just started a self-guided course. It's not on this topic. It's called No More Hitting. But if you've got a little bit of aggression running around in your family, like almost all of us do, it's a little 3-week course that you can take anytime you want via video and PDF, you know, online. And we have Building Emotional Understanding class so that you can get handy with using listening tools and get some really expert support and get familiar with how it is to use listening for yourself and for your own support through the Building Emotional Understanding class. Our instructors are really good. So we hope to be able to continue to support you well as parents. And thank you very much for coming. And Larry, you are wonderful. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Patty. It's a pleasure.
Thanks for being so clear and so warm and so informative. So good night, all. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.